radio check. Narrow radio check for Roger. And power is a go, 50,000 watts. Tone is down, is beautiful. Roger.
This is Bradley J on air control. We're listening at dawn. And our radios are tuned to 10:30. In our cars, it's locked on WBZ.
Oh, do you read me?
Affirmative, I read you.
What are you talking about?
This conversation can serve purpose.
BZ, you're Jay talking. We're live, midnight to 5. We have Drury R. Sherrod with the jury crisis. It seems that juries aren't all they're cracked up to be sometimes. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, you run a research firm, a jury research firm. Tell me about that.
Well, we jury researchers are sort of like the TV show Dr. Bull that a lot of people have seen, but that's a very amped up, cranked up version of what we do. Basically, jury researchers will run mock trials to help the client understand the likely verdict and how to prepare for it. So to do that, we recruit several hundred jurors, depending on the case, who match the people in the venue. They hear many versions of the trial, they fill out detailed questionnaires, and after we analyze those, we can understand the likelihood of what kind of verdict is likely to be turned in this case, what the damages might be, what alternative better strategies might be, and how to implement those. So that's what jury consultants do. I usually pause here and say we market justice.
Interesting. Speaking of market, it's expensive, I'm guessing. And I suppose that's what makes a defense, part of what makes a defense so very expensive. Is there any way you can give me a hint as to how much that kind of thing costs?
Well, probably a fraction of what lawyers bill. It is expensive, but it's only really worthwhile when a lot is at stake. When if a corporation is being sued, there's $50 million at stake or several billion dollars at stake. When it's in the company or the client's advantage to figure out what's going to happen to us.
Is the legal system moving away from trial by jury?
Intensely. That's the nut of my book, that what we're seeing right now is the shriveling on the vine of trial by jury. We are seeing the death of the jury trial in America. Trial by jury is enshrined in the Sixth and Seventh Amendments of the Constitution. But we are waiving our right to trial by jury. We're waiving it away.
It's very flawed. Is it necessarily the best thing? I know that it sounds good and it feels good to say that, but juries are flawed. Jury trial verdicts are flawed. Is that partly why they're going away?
I think part of why they're going away is jurors are mistrusted. Juries are denigrated. Juries are demeaned. Jury verdicts are ridiculed. I seldom work with an attorney when they don't mention the McDonald's coffee case of 25 years ago now. Often they mention the OJ case. Often people mention the Dr. Bull stuff on TV. So all of these tend to make juries look like they're easy to delude, easy to predict, unlikely to reach a just verdict.
Is that true? Or I should say, to what degree is that true?
Well, I would say you have to figure out where the problem lies. Is the problem with the court system, with judges, with attorneys, with law schools, or is it with jurors, the human brain? And so as we talk about this, I'm going to try to make a case that a lot of what happens to make jury verdicts not understandable is that information, evidence, trials aren't pitched to the level the human brain can understand. Trial by jury has been around for 900 years, since the Magna Carta, and it worked fine for probably 800 years. Over the last 100 years, and especially over the last sort of 20 to 30 years, that's when the cases have gotten just really too complicated for humans to follow very easily. If I can give a couple examples, you know, everybody knows about the El Chapo case.
Right.
That case went on for 3 months of testimony, lots of lurid witnesses' testimony. The judge gave 3 hours of instructions. You know, judges' instructions are pretty arcane and abstruse if you've ever heard them. And the jury deliberated for 7 days before reaching a verdict. And in those 7 days, they had to reach basically 54 verdict questions. It wasn't just a simple guilty or not guilty. There were different counts and subcounts. And we don't know how the jurors analyzed everything, because these people were too frightened to want to give any information about themselves. And no one from the New York Times, for example, has called them up to say, you know, how did you guys reach the decision you reached? Because these jurors fear retribution.
Interesting. If a juror does not understand the directions or parts of the trial, what is the default likely to be? They would default to not guilty because they wouldn't want to say guilty, not understanding?
Well, first they would send the judge lots of questions, probably saying, you know, we're kind of deadlocked. We don't understand this. Can you tell? Can you explain your instructions more clearly? For example, in the past year there were two Bill Cosby trials. The first Bill Cosby trial ended in a mistrial, and there were, I think, 52 hours of deliberations, and after 32 hours, the jurors said no one budged. They were interviewed in this case by the New York Times. The jurors said no one budged. So for the next 20 hours, they just sat there maintaining their positions. And, for example, they say they spent a whole day trying to decide what reckless meant, because one of the charges was that was the woman reckless for having gone to Cosby's room, knowing that they might be compromised in some way.
That makes sense, there's a legal definition of reckless, and they want to try to understand.
Yeah, they sent the judge an instruction, a question, like, what does reckless mean? And the judge said, you have to use your own common sense.
Oh, my God.
And basically, in the jury interview also, one of the jurors said what meant one thing to one person meant something else to another person. So they couldn't even agree. For example, reckless was a term they couldn't agree on what it meant. But in many trials, jurors from different walks of life see the facts, if there are facts, so differently that they actually appraise things like risk. Like, what is risk? You know, what is harm? What is reasonableness? What is ordinary care? All those words mean different things to different people. So in many cases, the juror's job is to be a trier of fact, to try facts, which means to ascertain if something actually happened. But often the facts are completely unknowable, so the jurors have to essentially use their common sense to kind of make up facts to fill in.
So wow, that's where you get to your concept of a story, but I'll get to that later. You mentioned juries try facts. They used to actually supply facts, correct?
Yeah, in the earliest days, there were no witnesses, there was no evidence. It was being a little Anglo-Saxon village. Everybody would know each other. The king would send an officer in. The officer would say, you know, this person is accused of stealing a neighbor's sheep. Let's say it's a nice Anglo-Saxon name, Godric. Godric stole his neighbor's sheep. The jurors then just have a little conversation for about half an hour. You know, I've known Godric all his life. Would he have done something like that? Somebody else says, I don't know. He's been acting strange lately. Somebody else says, well, I saw a sheepskin cover in his cart the other day. And then that's the way they would reach a verdict.
And then the officer would reach the verdict, or they reach it themselves?
Well, they would reach a verdict, and often they would change facts because they liked the person and they thought the accusation was unfair by the king's officers. So they would make up facts to exonerate the person. So trial by jury has always been, early on it was jurors supplied facts. They weren't triers of fact. They supplied the facts themselves. And that's one question that we'll talk about, is whether we still do that. Do we still make up facts and ignore facts that don't fit our stories? There's a really interesting series of psychology experiments. They were done a few decades back, but they were done in Boston, and they had to do with a murder that took place in Boston. There were two men, a very large man and a small, slight man, who had a quarrel in a bar. They left that night. They each came back to the bar. They went outside, had a little fight. The big man had a straight razor, the small man had a fishing knife. After some contact between the two of them, the big man was stabbed to death and he fell to the ground, and the small man was arrested for murder. So there was a trial, and then the psychologists actually reenacted. They hired actors to film this whole trial. They filmed the trial. All the witnesses, all the subjects were hired actors, and then they hired subjects who were potential jurors, who actually could have been selected for a jury in Boston. And they had these subjects watch the reenactment that was filmed of the trial. And then the experimenter would be sitting there, and as the trial began on film, the subject would be sitting right at the experimenter's elbow. And the experimenter would say, tell us everything. Be one of the jurors. Tell us everything that goes through your head as you're watching this film. And what turned out was fascinating, that almost from the very beginning, jurors started telling stories like, you know, the smaller man had this fishing knife because he was afraid for his life. Or the smaller man had been humiliated early in the day and he came back to settle the score. So they started telling stories right away, and the stories reflected events from their own life. And I think this is fascinating. Almost half of what the jurors talked about during these mock deliberations were never presented as evidence. It was only events from their own life which were similar to the trial. So the evidence, there's no real evidence. And when they were given a list of statements that actually were in the trial, they would ignore the statements. They would say, I've never heard this before, if it didn't fit their view, their verdict. And they would falsely remember statements that were never presented that did fit their verdict. So essentially, they make up a story. They arrive at a story. They use that to reach a verdict. They use that to guide what they attend to during the cases that are, when the evidence is presented.
So if that's the case, then the whole case is won or lost in jury selection.
Well, partly there, also largely in how information is presented to jurors. If you know that jurors are storytellers, then why would you present evidence to them as in a non-narrative way, which is typically what attorneys will do. They will have, say, a yellow pad, 50 yeah. statements. They check off each one, something, this witness is going to testify to this, this witness to this, this other witness to this. The witnesses come in out of order. Jurors aren't really able to fit it together. Instead of first giving them an overall narrative, and then having the narrative be fairly simple, you know, with several themes, and then having using the narrative to explain the evidence that jurors will hear, and then having each witness understand how his role relates to the overall narrative.
I see. If you don't give them a story, they fill in the blanks with their own story that's highly based on their personal experience. So you need to fill in the story, every detail of the story that you, that in a way that benefits you.
Yeah, or you could say in a way that makes the facts clearer.
Oh,
and then,
well.
And then, but you still have people with different backgrounds making a different story. I mean, you can't completely hijack the jurors and give them a story and then change their minds and have them ignore anything that doesn't fit the story you tried to implant. You can't implant stories. That's kind of a Dr. Bull thing. What you can do is help the jurors to clarify their verdicts as much as possible via the stories they tell, so that when they deliberate, they can realize they're really talking about stories instead of facts.
Okay, how does the story scenario, well, let me phrase it differently, how does the OJ case display this in this storytelling, story creation in action?
Okay, I think that's a really interesting question. Because I think that at the time, the national polls showed that 85% of black people thought OJ was innocent, and about 85% of white people thought he was guilty. And there were 8 black people on the jury, so it wasn't hard for me to tell my friends it's going to be acquittal by noon. And I think the reason is that I lived near L.A. then and still do. The reason is that most African-Americans in L.A. had been hassled, harassed in some way by the LAPD. So for them, it made complete sense, the allegation that a racist cop had jiggered the evidence and moved some evidence around and maybe faked the blood. Whereas white people saw that as just too bizarre. Police wouldn't do that. So the African Americans on the jury and in the panel, the national panel, actually saw different facts than the white people saw. So they told different stories because they started off drawing experiences from their own lives. African Americans had been harassed, insulted by the LAPD. So they draw those stories that reflect that, and it makes it highly plausible that the police had somehow tricked the evidence.
Including the DNA evidence, that somehow their story rendered the DNA evidence not effective?
See, I think they thought the evidence had been substituted, had been mishandled in storage, or something had been moved around, the glove had been moved around, or the blood that they found had been planted by the racist cop. See, once you have a story, then you look for evidence that you seek out evidence that supports your story, and you make up facts that support the story.
Well, you know, we see that every day when in my job here, if we do a political topic, we see the right supplying their story and the left supplying an entirely different story over the same set of facts. So it's not just in juries. Yeah. We all do it. So you get to voir dire. How does the knowledge that you have affect how that goes? And how, has that process evolved?
Yeah, here's a couple of things. Partly, it depends on who shows up, who answers the jury summons. There are nice and recent current data that about 15% of people who receive jury summons actually never receive them. They've moved, they've changed their addresses haven't been updated. No one has managed to track them down. So 15% of jury summons are non-deliverable. Another probably 12%, I think 12% is the figure, of people who actually get their summons simply ignore them. They pretend they never got it. And most people can get away with it, although in some states who are trying to control this, If somebody's pulled over for a traffic violation, the officer might say, I noticed also you've skipped your jury duty three different times in a row. We could actually arrest you for that, sir. Do you realize that? So some states do it through threat. Some states do it through making it easier. Like in California, you call in each morning for 6 or 7 days, and the automatic voice tells you if you're needed to show up or not. So that's one problem, that the people who show up are not a cross-section. And then the second problem there is that of the people who show up, there are pretty liberal excuses given to strike people. For example, you can strike some people because they clearly seem to have already made up their mind and say to the judge, I couldn't keep an open mind. And then after the strikes for cause, there are peremptory strikes where attorneys can just strike, say, 6 to 12 people because they don't like him or because he's thinking that lady's squinting at me or I've never gotten along with a man who wore that color tie. So that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then it comes down to, and I think that's your question that I'm finally getting to, it comes down to, so what do you do with voir dire? And the first part of this answer is that if you're selecting, if you know that people are going to tell stories, then you have to realize that voir dire is about storytelling. So you have to figure out who's going to tell what kind of story. And the reason, I mean, how you figure that out is not the way most attorneys go about it, like asking, what's the last three books you've read? You know, what are your favorite TV shows? What bumper stickers do you have on your car? That doesn't work very well. What works is very detailed questionnaires that you would have the jurors fill out with a whole series of questions about their specific attitudes, lifestyles, experiences, values that relate directly to the case. So you can get a pretty good sense of, given how people answered this whole cluster of questions about the events from their own life that most directly resemble the case, we can probably predict how those people are going to vote.
Now, given that there are so many problems with, and there have been problems for some time with jury trials, why are they so valuable? Why are they held so dear? And wouldn't one judge, of course, is very likely to be not impartial, but maybe a panel of judges or professional jurors. Why wouldn't that be better?
Okay, two levels of that question. The first is that trial by jury is when jurors speak truth to power. It's when they tell the state that you can't incarcerate or execute this individual. It's when they tell corporations that you made a defective product that took some lives and you're going to pay $150 million for this.
I see what you're saying. It gives the everyday Joe some muscle.
Yeah, and also, America takes juries much more seriously than any other country. Most of Europe has remnants of the Napoleonic system, where magistrates or judges arrive at verdicts for most cases, except those that are extremely difficult or could potentially lead to long incarceration. Whereas in America, all those kind of cases go to individual jurors, just everyday people. That's really the magic and the miracle of the American system.
Okay, and that's a system of professional jurors wouldn't work or wouldn't be so good. You wouldn't favor that.
No, and the reason would be that judges, arbitrators, mediators, the kind of experts who you might recall professional jurors, those people also have the same kind of their brains work the same way that regular jurors' brains do. They also leap to conclusions. They tell stories. They tell stories that are more vivid and understandable to them than performing a complex analytic overview of all different types of evidence. So they also are guided by stories. And you tend to have the power to tell these stories vested in just a handful of people, like one person, say, in an arbitrator, or maybe three people in a three-judge panel in a federal appellate case.
All right.
So you don't escape storytelling, ever.
I appreciate that. Drury R. Sherrod. This is a really good book. I actually have an attorney friend I'm going to pass it on to. Thank you. The Jury Crisis. What's wrong with jury trials and how we can save them? We just went over some main facts. There's a lot more in here, and you might want to pick it up. I think, folks, a lot of you would like it. And thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I'm happy being here.
All right. There you go. There's another episode of the Jay Talkin' Podcast. Follow me on Twitter for show updates. If you loved what you heard, like and review the show. It helps others find us. And as always, you can catch the show live, Jay Talkin' Live, every weeknight starting Sunday, midnight to 5 on WBZ, Boston's News Radio.